Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Last week, the state of Oklahoma rested its case against opioid manufacturer Johnson & Johnson. After almost 40 consecutive days of testimony, Judge Thad Balkman is expected to issue a decision sometime in August. At stake is whether the company will be found guilty of creating a public nuisance, which could result in a multi-million, some say multi-billion dollar judgment against the company. The eyes of the nation have been on Oklahoma because this trial has been the first of potentially hundreds of other state and local lawsuits against drug companies blamed for causing and worsening the opioid epidemic in the United States. As you're probably aware, the drug company Purdue Pharma, most famous for its drug OxyContin, which it promoted relentlessly, chose to settle with the state of Oklahoma rather than face trial and agreed to pay $270 million to the state for damages. Following all of this news and reporting both statewide and nationally for NPR has been our own Jackie Fortier, the health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. Fortier has been in the courtroom or press room for every day of the trial, and her dispatches and live tweeting have been a staple for followers of the trial. If you're an avid KWGS listener, you've heard Jackie's reports on both our local news segments and on the national feeds of Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Jackie Fortier, health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Jackie Fortier, welcome to Medical Monday. You've been spending quite a bit of time at the Oklahoma's opioid trial recently. So tell us how it finished up and what was kind of the scope. I mean, it was many days long that you were there reporting.
Yeah, and I've actually been reporting on the opioid trial since really the beginning of the year. I did a grand total the other day, and I've done 49 local spots and about 39 national spots on the opioid trial. But the trial was 7 weeks long in Norman, Oklahoma, and it was brought by the Attorney General of Oklahoma, Mike Hunter. Initially, there were three companies involved in the lawsuit. It was Purdue Pharma, Teva Pharmaceuticals, and Johnson & Johnson. Purdue Pharma and Teva Pharmaceuticals settled before the trial, so Johnson & Johnson was the only company to actually go to trial. So it was 7 weeks long. Both sides have rested, so now we are waiting on a verdict from the judge.
And let's talk about that judge. The judge in the case was Thad Balkman. What do you know about him?
Yeah, Thad Balkman has not been a judge for really all that long, just a few years. This is certainly his largest case. He also told me that it was the longest case that he has ever presided over.
Huh. And there was a parade of witnesses. Now, I was following certainly your dispatches locally as well as the national spots, but you did some writing as well. But what was really fun was following your tweets as you were live tweeting the trial. And so I know there were dozens of witnesses called by the state, not as many by Johnson & Johnson. What were some of the highlights that stood out to you?
Yeah, there were 38 witnesses overall. Those were for both sides. There could have been a lot more. They definitely deposed more people before the trial began. But the judge was really strict about wanting to keep them to a timeline. He wanted them to finish up by the end of July. They ended up finishing a little bit early. Keep in mind, though, you know, Teva Pharmaceuticals settled just days before the trial. So I think that last 2 weeks would have been for Teva. And that's why Johnson & Johnson only took 2 weeks in their defense. There were some really interesting moments from both sides. We heard from multiple parents who had lost children to opioid addiction, and we also saw a lot of Oklahomans who had themselves been addicted to opioids. They told their stories. When Johnson & Johnson would cross them, they were very careful and sympathetic about that. And they would simply ask them if it had been any of Johnson & Johnson's products. And none of the people that were on the stand talking about their history or their family members' history with opioid use disorder said that it had been Johnson & Johnson's products, or if it might have been, but they were unaware. And that was really something. Yeah, that was something that Johnson & Johnson came back to. They focused on their products specifically. Johnson & Johnson has made the point throughout the trial that they shouldn't be the opioid scapegoat and that they shouldn't be on the hook for the entire opioid crisis in the state when they had such a small market share of the opioids that they used to produce. They don't produce all of them to the state anymore. Some of the other really interesting witnesses, we heard from a lot of experts in various fields. We heard from one expert from the University of Miami. He was called by Johnson & Johnson, and he talked about the role of drug cartels bringing drugs into the United States and how that's been going on for decades and how the state of Oklahoma, as well as the federal government, has known that that's been a problem and that it's very difficult to tell, for example, when you're doing an autopsy and running these tests to see if a drug, a lot of them are manufactured to look like pharmaceutical drugs. So it's hard to tell from a chemical standpoint if it was a pharmaceutical drug overdose or not. You know, you can check a PDMP too, but...
Well, that's just to cast doubt, you mean, on whether or not someone has actually died of prescription opioids versus illegal street narcotics? Is that to call that into question?
Yes, exactly. So Johnson & Johnson is really, really trying to drill down and focus on their own opioids that they produced and on prescription opioids specifically. This case is not about, you know, illicit opioids. It's about what they knew and when they knew it. And that's really what the trial focused on.
Interesting. Okay. So 38 witnesses, Judge Thad Balkman. Now, this was called a bench trial, which I'm very non-lawyerly. So what that meant is it was not a jury trial. There was no jury. And what can you tell us about why it was a bench trial and didn't go to a jury and who that may or may not have advantaged?
You're right. It is a bench trial. So that means that the judge is going to decide Johnson & Johnson's guilt or innocence, and then he's also going to decide whether or not they pay. The state is asking for more than $17 billion. So the judge will decide if they pay and how much. In late March, Purdue Pharma settled with the state for a package deal of $270 million. And there had been three defendants on the case. And after Purdue settled with the state, the Attorney General's office, dropped almost all of the claims, which is what they're called in civil court. They'd be called charges in a criminal court. But they dropped almost all the claims against the remaining two companies of Teva and Johnson & Johnson and hung the entire case on one claim, which is public nuisance. And when I talked to the Attorney General about that, he said that they were being buried under a flood of documents from Johnson & Johnson's lawyers and that they really wanted to streamline the process and make sure that they could get to the trial date of May 28th and that they had dropped those other claims in order to pursue a bench trial. So you have actually this kind of interesting conversation going on where Johnson & Johnson's lawyers were pushing for a jury trial and the state wanted a bench trial, and they ended up getting a bench trial, which is what they asked for, and they got the start date of May 28th.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jackie Fortier. She is the health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma and has been covering both the opioid epidemic and the opioid trial that was just wrapped up in Oklahoma. It actually took place in Norman. It was a bench trial presided over by Judge Thad Balkman. And Jackie, you alluded to the fact that Attorney General Mike Hunter dropped all of the other claims against Johnson & Johnson because, as you pointed out, Teva Pharmaceuticals and Purdue Pharma both settled with the state, leaving it with only the claim of public nuisance. Now, this was a questionable legal strategy because some experts thought this company should be held liable for creating a public nuisance with the opioid drugs that it marketed in the state, while others were saying, you know, the definition of public nuisance is such that this doesn't really fall under that at all. What can you tell us about the history of claims of public nuisance in the past?
Public nuisance refers to actions that harm members of the public, including injury to public health. But it's really broad, and every state has their own public nuisance statute. Oklahoma's is especially broad. So the state attorney general, in choosing to go with simply one claim of public nuisance, there's a couple reasons for that. The broadness of it, you know, if the judge finds in his favor, it was a good idea, right? But under Oklahoma's statute, the attorney general doesn't have a limit on how much abatement he can ask for. So if it was another party bringing this lawsuit, they would have a limit, but the attorney general doesn't. So that was another reason why Attorney General Mike Hunter decided to hang the entire case on public nuisance. you know, a lot of legal scholars that I've talked to are still scratching their heads, wondering if that was a good idea. It has kind of a checkered history. There's been cases in the past, the tobacco industry lawsuit, for example, back in the 90s, that was public nuisance. They ended up settling. So it did, you know, bring them to the table, certainly. There was litigation against gun makers. That was also public nuisance. And they found that, you know, gun makers are not liable for what people do after they have bought the firearms. It can really go both ways. But neither of those cases were in Oklahoma. So it'll be really interesting to see how the judge rules. We're expecting him to write a decision. And when I've talked to legal scholars, they've said that he's going to have to be really specific about, if he finds for the state, why public nuisance applies in this case and why it wouldn't apply in other cases.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the, I guess, media aspects of the trial, because this was a national news story. And in Oklahoma, this was the first lawsuit to go to trial in the United States, where a jurisdiction was suing a pharmaceutical firm about the opioid epidemic, about causation and potentiation. And it took place right here in Oklahoma, which made us a big hub of news. And so your reporting has been featured nationwide. Now, when the trial opened, my understanding is there were quite a few national reporters on hand, but very few stuck with it for the full 7 weeks. So tell us a little bit about the story and what some of the press room goings-on looked like.
It's up to the judge, first and foremost, on if there's going to be cameras. And Thad Bachman decided that there would be. But in order for it to not turn into, you know, a media circus that everyone always says that it might, if you think back to something like the O.J. Simpson trial, or where there were a lot of cameras in the courtroom, they didn't want that. So there were only two cameras allowed in the courtroom. There was one pool still photographer a day, and then there was a court TV network, and they ran the cameras. I was actually up in the broadcast media room. So under the court's orders, the only way that you could record any of it is if you were physically there. So in order for me to record it, I had to go to court every day. And I would watch from the camera everything that was going on. And there were two different camera angles that had actually been agreed upon by Johnson & Johnson's lawyers and the state, so that it didn't show any of the papers in front of them during the trial, so you couldn't read over their shoulder any notes that they were potentially passing to each other. You know, in the broadcast media room, we had a little bit, slightly more of a relaxed atmosphere than certainly being in the courtroom. I did go down to the courtroom every day and, you know, talk to lawyers and everything. But it was really interesting. You know, the first day of the trial, CNN was there. They had brought a truck. They were live streaming the whole opening statements. You know, there was a French documentary film crew that I did an interview with. They were asking me about the trial. There was Guardian newspaper out of London. They had sent a reporter who's actually, you know, based in the U.S., but they sent him down here, and all the TV news from the local TV stations. And then by day three, all the international press was long gone. The national press was long gone after day two. And by day three, it was me, public radio, two of the local newspapers, and I think three of the local TV stations. By the end of the week, it was me and two newspaper reporters. By the end of the second week, it was me and one newspaper reporter. We were the only two who covered the entire trial, but the newspaper reporter actually took a vacation in the middle of it, so they sent a different reporter. So I ended up being the only reporter that was there every day for the entire trial. I'm sure everybody will come back for the verdict.
It's so interesting because I guess I just think, first of all, what a great opportunity afforded you as a reporter, you know, to do sort of this very important healthcare story, you know, right there in Norman, where you're based. So that's really interesting in and of itself. And then, of course, the sort of, you know, winnowing musical chairs of who was there. I mean, it must have gotten kind of lonely after that initial burst of attention.
Yeah, it was interesting. The Attorney General's office actually said, you know, why isn't there more press here? Their PIO asked me that, and I said, well, you know, there's dwindling newsrooms, and unfortunately, a lot of them can't send someone here every day. So I was really fortunate as a public radio reporter that, you know, our listeners see the value in this, and they want the full context of the story, and that's something that we decided to do, and that I would, you know, cover the entire trial, because it's really hard to parachute in every 3 weeks or so and try to keep up with what's going on and do accurate contextualized reporting on something this complicated. It's really tough. So I was really fortunate to be there the whole time.
Well, and in many ways, you'll become the narrative because you were the consistent presence there in the courtroom. And so it's as if your reporting will be the sort of the narrative objective structure of what took place over those 7 weeks, which is really interesting. Jackie, I want to ask you about something that we all either probably love or mostly hate, which is Twitter. I think news reporters really like it because you get a lot of tips on Twitter and you can see things that are trending or that may be of interest, but we all know what a sort of liability Twitter has become with hate speech and other forms of intimidation or trolling. But you had several dispatches on Twitter that I think lots of people, at least when I looked in on the Twitter feed, many people were showing their incredible appreciation of you being the beacon that was there holding up the lamplight for people who were interested in following what was going on in the trial. Did you have any sense of how many people were following along or who was following along or those kinds of things?
Yeah, it was I decided early on to live tweet the trial. And so I live tweeted all 33 days of the trial. You know, sometimes it was easier than others, but it also, you know, made me pay attention the whole time. It's something that I could do and let people know and kind of give them the highlights because, you know, frankly, everybody has jobs. Most people can't watch, you know, 8 hours of a trial all day for understandable reasons, and they might not be able to listen or they might miss, you know, one of my news spots. So I thought that it was really important to let people know what was going on because, I mean, this trial is just, it has huge ramifications no matter which way it goes. Yeah, it was a really interesting experience. I had a lot of people who didn't tweet to me that I found out later were reading it. Quite a few physicians across the U.S., a lot of lawyers and a lot of legal scholars. I called up a woman and to do an interview with her, and she said, "Oh, I know you from Twitter." And I was like, "Oh, well, that's fantastic." And the only thing that she knew about the goings-on in the trial was from what I had tweeted, which, you know, is a little bit of pressure. But I was just trying to give people the back and forth and some of the interesting questions that either opposing side was posing to a witness. I don't have any numbers specifically on how many people were following me or watching at a given time, but there were a lot of people who were really kind and they were very happy that I was continuing the live tweet. I will say, though, after, you know, about 3 weeks, I was like, boy, this is getting tough because you really have to pay attention all the time, and that can just get exhausting.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jackie Fortier. She is the health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, who we are very lucky to have here reporting in the state on healthcare issues, which is a consortium of all the public radio stations in Oklahoma, and it's a statewide project. And Jackie Fortier was there at all 33 days of the recently concluded opioid trial that took place in Norman, Oklahoma, against Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceuticals. And Jackie, one thing I want to just, because I think a lot of our listeners are don't go near Twitter, I want to just explain live tweeting is sort of you're there and you're just sending tweets out to your followers or to anyone who can see you, just kind of very short, you know, two-sentence posts about what's happening or who's testifying now and what the gist of what they're saying is, that kind of a thing. That's what live tweeting is as it's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what I tried to do is I tried not to editorialize in any way other than, you know, maybe saying like, well, the lawyers are arguing now over a motion. But I really tried to directly quote people as much as possible to give them an idea of, you know, how a witness was responding to, you know, Johnson & Johnson's question or something along those lines. But yeah, that's exactly what live tweeting is.
Okay, editorial opportunity here. I know you want to refrain and be a professional journalist, but how do you think Judge Balkman will decide this case? And I guess, you know, what are the issues that it hinges on? And I guess what outcomes are we likely to see?
We're still waiting for a verdict. He's going to take a few weeks. The lawyers have to get in their findings of fact and a couple of other things. And then we're expecting a decision in August. But it could come sooner. It's totally up to the judge. He's going to write a decision. The claim that this is on is public nuisance. So the state is alleging that Johnson & Johnson created a public nuisance in their goings-on with the opioids that they sold and marketing was a really big part of this trial. The judge could find in favor of the state. The state is asking for $17.5 billion at the most. That would fund a 30-year abatement plan that the state has put forward. That would fund just a slew of public health initiatives that the state currently lacks right now. One of them, of course, would be opioid use treatment, addiction treatment overall. There would even be an emphasis on adverse childhood events and helping kids with those. It's a very science-backed plan. But it's up to the judge, of course, if Johnson & Johnson would have to pay anything. So if he finds in favor of the state, it's really going to bolster these other lawsuits that are going on right now. There's a really big case in Ohio that's this huge consolidated case of about 1,600, you know, local and tribal governments that are suing these drug makers, Johnson & Johnson being one of them. If Oklahoma wins, it's really going to bolster their side and maybe bring them to the settlement table. If the state loses, it really does the opposite. It's going to bolster whomever the drug manufacturers are and these others, specifically on a public nuisance claim. And they might be able to say, you know, they're going to point to the Oklahoma decision and say, look, this is what the judge said and why. So whatever the judge writes is going to be quoted a lot.
That really does sound like a lot of pressure on Judge Balkman. Well, if you, let's say you were the judge, did you find one side of the case more compelling than the other? Or, you know, did both sides make compelling points?
They both made really compelling points. Attorney General Mike Hunter's lawsuit alleged that Johnson & Johnson and its subsidiary, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, helped ignite the opioid crisis with these really aggressive marketing techniques. Their overall case was about the prescription opioid crisis in general. And they kept calling Johnson & Johnson a kingpin. And the reason why was because Johnson & Johnson used to own these two companies called Noramco and Tasmanian Alkaloids, which produced this raw narcotic that Johnson & Johnson then sold to almost all the other opioid manufacturers. So the state's saying that Johnson & Johnson went out and influenced, you know, medical journals, influenced doctors, knowing that almost any opioid sale would benefit their bottom line. But we found out during the trial that not only did Johnson & Johnson profit from the sale of almost any opioid, including OxyContin, which is one of the big drivers that's produced by Purdue. It was one of the big drivers of the opioid crisis. But they also profited from opioid treatment drugs, including buprenorphine and naloxone, which is used in Narcan, which is the opioid overdose reversal drug.
Yeah, reversal agent, right.
They profited from that because they were also making the raw narcotic that goes into both of those drugs as well. So that was just a huge blockbuster moment in the trial, hearing that Johnson & Johnson profited from both sides of the opioid crisis. Johnson & Johnson, you know, said, look, we operate under federal and state laws. Any of the raw narcotic that we brought into the United States, the DEA knew all about it. We have to supply these other pharmaceutical companies. We were in perfect compliance with them. It's up to doctors who get an opioid prescription, and they are very intelligent individuals who went to medical school for a long time, and we really couldn't have influenced them. Johnson & Johnson also said that they have a very small market share for the opioids that they used to produce. So keep in mind that we are talking about the height of the opioid crisis. So about from 2000 through, you know, 2011, 2012 in Oklahoma. So it might not be something that the company is necessarily producing right now. But they both had really strong arguments.
Well, it certainly is going to be interesting to find out what the verdict is in this case, and if Judge Balkman finds for the state of Oklahoma essentially what the damages will be assessed at, because as you point out, the state is asking and has created a plan over a 30-year abatement plan, 30 years, three decades, a $17.5 billion. So, you know, presumably if the state wins, it'll get some, you know, fraction of that, but in any way, a lot of money. Now, shifting gears a little bit, not related specifically to the trial, but still on the opioid story, you've wrote another story for State Impact Oklahoma about the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We alluded to the settlement that the state of Oklahoma made with Purdue Pharma, a $270 million settlement, the lion's share of which is going to go to a national center on addiction at Oklahoma State University. And apparently the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has sent notice that they intend to get a clawback on some of that money, because since Medicaid dollars were used to provide treatment for those patients who were harmed, some of those dollars should be paid back to the federal government. I noticed you had a funny comment in your article where Attorney General Mike Hunter acknowledged in a speech that rose petals were not strewn in his path by the state legislators whom he went around in terms of reaching that deal. What can you tell us about this proposed clawback?
So think back to when Purdue settled with the state for that $270 million. About $200 million of that will go to that addiction and treatment center that you talked about at Oklahoma State University. That's the idea. And that was the decision that Hunter made without any input from the legislature. And they were not happy about that. The legislators even passed a law after the Purdue settlement that would now apply to the Teva settlement, saying that any future settlement would have to go through the legislature and they would have to be at least consulted. Medicaid is a government health insurance program for the poor, funded jointly by state and federal funds. And for the current year right now, the federal government is picking up about 62% of the cost of Oklahoma's annual $5 billion Medicaid program. Under normal circumstances, the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, which administers our Medicaid program, which is called SoonerCare, files these quarterly reports, and then they true up with each other if one side is owed a little bit. But if there's an overpayment determined, then it's taken out of like the next quarter's payment. So with the Purdue settlement, CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, said, hey, some of that money that you're getting back, we're owed because we help pay for your Medicaid program. And you're saying that some of that was Medicaid fraud. We would like you to calculate how much you owe us. And if the state chooses not to comply with the amount of money that CMS says that they're owed, CMS could simply take it out of the state's Medicaid payment. So in one way or the other, the federal government is more than likely going to get their money. The state of Oklahoma has until mid-October to send the federal government the documents pertaining to the Purdue settlement, and it'll go from there. But it's been really interesting to follow. Legal scholars that I've talked to have said that the state really should have seen this coming, because this has been the way it works with Medicaid since Medicaid began. So there's a few things that they could do. The state could choose to settle with the federal government. You know, it's still unclear how Oklahoma would pay for it, because you got to remember, the state doesn't actually have any of this Purdue money. Right now, it's sitting in a separate account. It's not in the general account at the state legislature. It's sitting in the separate account, and it has to go to Oklahoma State University for this addiction and treatment center under the settlement agreement with Purdue Pharma. So how the state will pay for any of the money that it owes CMS is really the big question right now.
Well, Jackie Fortier, I think that as listeners, we all should put rose petals in your path, because you have done an incredible job of reporting on the opioid trial and all of the ancillary issues around it, but also just on healthcare in general for State Impact Oklahoma. We are very lucky to have you here, and thanks for making the time to break this down for us.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so much for having me.
Jackie Fortier is the health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, and she spoke to us about the recently completed opioid trial that took place in Norman. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.